Hey, Slowpokes, do you like video games?
Do you like classic video games?
Do you like not paying for classic video games?
Well, us Slowpokes have something for you.
We're running a giveaway for a Super Nintendo Classic Mini.
So check out our Facebook page at facebook.com/Slowpokes Podcast.
Or our Twitter account at @SlowpokesCast for the details on how you can enter.
That's two entries for one giveaway.
So jump onto your internet device and give it a share, and you could be in the running for this classic SNES console.
The draw closes soon, so get in quick.
Welcome, folks, to the Slowpokes Podcast. As always, I'm Slowpoke number 2, David Chalante.
And I'm Slowpoke number 1, John Nicolaitis.
Today, my good slow friends, we are talking about a game that I played actually quite a while ago.
Yeah.
That John has only just played very, very recently.
Yes.
It is a widely lauded game, the magnum opus of the company that made it, who I don't think have made anything since.
They're currently working on a game.
Good, because they're very good at these things.
Yeah.
Today's game is Journey.
Yes.
A PS3 exclusive at launch, now just a PS exclusive, made by that game company in March of 2012.
Yes.
Is when that was released.
Yes, yeah. And this is the third game they actually released. Can't remember both of the previous ones. I know one was called Flow, where you with this weird little creature that sort of swims around.
Yeah, the second
soup.
Name is very easy to remember. It's Flower. It's Flow-er.
I never played Flower. I have it. I've never played it.
Yeah, so I played both Flow and Flower. Flow never really grabbed me just because it's a little bit too simple.
Mm-hmm.
Flower I got about halfway through, but I played Journey before both of them. I bought them all as one package. Relatively close to the release date, at least by our standards. It would have been at most like a year afterwards.
Yeah. So really early. A whole year.
It definitely wasn't at launch though, because other people had told me that I should be playing it.
Mm.
So yeah, I mean, I would have played that around that time. You, John, however, you only played that in the last few days, right?
It's so funny what kind of games you do and don't play. And this is like a game I should have played. I had time to have played it, but I never did. And lots of people that I liked, lots of reviewers and people I would consider intelligent said to play it. I just never got around to it. It probably would have been wasted on me at the time. So I'm kind of glad.
Yeah. See, I don't think it was wasted on me at the time. I had an incredible experience with it when I did play it. But I do think that my appreciation for its more subtle elements, I'm glad that I had an excuse to replay it as part of the show.
Yeah.
My expectations of it back at the time were very basic, that, you know, very good music, very atmospheric, because that was sort of what that game company was famous for.
Yeah.
Very emotional but inexplicit kind of experiences. You know, no dialogue, no heavily explicit plot, but more of a plot through implication and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And this is the game that they've made that has the most, like, story in a typical sense in it, rather than more of a thematic exploration using visuals and whatnot.
Yeah, they're very experiential.
Yeah, that's a very good word to describe it.
Great. I didn't know it was a real world. I was just expecting to be very sad. That's from a lot of people.
Really?
Yeah. A lot of people said that the game made them very sad.
See, I think that's very strange. And we'll talk about why in a moment. It's definitely emotionally affecting. Absolutely.
Yes.
And some of that is positive and some of that is negative. But to describe the game as sad, I really don't think is accurate.
Yeah, and after playing it, I did feel a kind of sadness. But I didn't find myself weeping. And I really didn't find myself with that sense of loss.
See, sadness, I think, is an imperfect word to describe a very broad range of emotional experiences. generally, when it comes to this word is insufficient, it's advantageous to become more specific with language.
Yes.
But I think in this case, cathartic, which is an incredibly general term, is a much better way to describe the emotional... I was about to say emotional journey of Journey,
and
that's going to be a very difficult thing about this episode, that we're going to have to find synonyms for Journey. The emotional path, the emotional exploration that you go through.
I'm just really annoyed that you got to do it, because I wrote down, I wanted to be the one who said Journey, that the game was a journey. But
yeah.
No, it's fine, David, you can be natural about it. But I found cathartic's a great word for it. I really just, you know, it's that feeling you get when you just see something that you feel is wonderfully put together.
Yeah.
Right? And it just moves and flows almost perfectly.
Mm.
And you're just like, nice.
I think as well, when it comes to the sadness, like the bittersweet kind of feeling that you might have with playing, because I've definitely had an experience like that. I think it's less about the game making you feel sad and more about the fact that you need to walk away from the game and return to a more kind of plain kind of experience of the world. Like, you leave that magic circle where, you know, you've had this emotional experience and you step away from it and it's like, oh, I'm sad that I'm leaving this game behind in a way, less so much than... Like I said, replaying this game for the podcast has been an awesome experience for me because I've been able to think about this game in a way that I didn't think about it at the time. Now, one of the things I should mention as well is a really big thing people talk about with the game journey is its relationship with the hero's journey, a literary analysis kind of structure.
If we were a tackier podcast, we would play a sound effect every time we say the word journey.
Ba-ding! Yeah. Or whatever. So, for those of you who don't know, and I imagine most of you have at least heard of it at this point. But
I feel like it's quite a ubiquitous kind of literary idea.
And the thing is, before I even talk about this, the concept of the hero's journey is a little bit like the Wilhelm Scream or Unobtainium or something like that, where a few years ago, it was kind of played with a lot in art because it was still kind of an in-joke.
Yeah.
But now that a lot more people understand what it is, saying, oh, this game explores the idea of a hero's journey, it sounds a lot tackier than it did at the time this game was released. But the broad kind of idea of a hero's journey is that Joseph Campbell wrote a book called The Hero with 1,000 Faces,
yes,
basically exploring this idea of the monomyth, the idea that all cultures on Earth, or a lot of cultures on Earth, tell myths in very similar ways,
yeah,
that there are very similar beats and tropes to basically all of our myth-making.
I think the traditional one they bring up is the Jesus-like figures that appear in lots of different cultures,
absolutely.
Historical stories.
That's definitely part of it, but also more folklorish tales like, you know, King Arthur, Sir Galahad, that kind of stuff that isn't quite so specifically cultural and specifically religious. And then there's also just pop culture stuff. Like, the most famous thing that you'll hear in relation to the hero's journey is the original Star Wars film, A New Hope, that is pointed to as being something that follows that structure very well.
Yeah.
And Lucas has said many times that he was influenced by Campbell's writing. Now, from a literary analysis perspective, the idea of the hero's journey, the idea of the monomyth, the idea that there's one template that all stories fit to, in my opinion, fucking bullshit. Like, that's just a waste of time to think about. But it is fun in the way that thinking about astrology is fun.
Sure.
Like, it's very deliberately general, and it's kind of fun to look at that and say, oh, how does this fit in? But in reality, it's not actually useful in a scholarly way.
Sure. I mean, it's like these kind of tiny models that aren't actually perfect are very useful in the greater analysis of things.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know if it's an appropriate parallel, but I know, like, the Bechdel test.
I was going to say the exact same thing, yeah.
You know, how the Bechdel test is like, do two women in a movie talk about things that are not men?
Yeah,
right?
See, and the Bechdel test is a really good example of what you're talking about, because it's a fun thing to think about,
yes,
and it's a good starting point to generate conversations, but it is not in any way useful as an actual litmus test.
Yes.
A really great example is the movie Gravity fails the Bechdel test. Mm-hmm. There aren't two women to have a conversation in it, but Sandra Bullock is fucking amazing in that movie.
Yes.
Whereas other movies that are very sexist actually pass the Bechdel test because two women talk about dresses or something.
Sure.
You know?
But like you said, like we're talking about, you know, these ideas are just useful to have in mind to think about the media and text that we sort of analyze.
Yeah, absolutely. And the reason we bring all of that up is because Journey in a deliberate way is illusory or is sort of built in that template.
Mm.
And again, while that's not necessarily groundbreaking, it's not changing the way we look at art or anything like that, it is clever and it is fun and it is used in a way to inform the experience that you have with the game. The way we're going to talk about this one, John and I had a discussion before the show, is going to be a little bit different. Normally we go through by sort of like topic points or like artistic disciplines.
General tent poles of video games, like how they're made to sort of meander through.
Mm. But considering that Journey is a journey, we are going to take you on a journey of our journeys through Journey. By just sort of going through the game basically as it's laid out and talking about the experience as it unfolds. And I think that's just sort of a more useful way to discuss this.
Yes. So if you're interested in the game, I would suggest you play it. Otherwise, join us on this journey through Journey.
Yes. So the game is broken up into broad chapters. I think there's about 8 or 9 of them.
Yeah, sort of.
It's written down, but off the top of my head, somewhere between like 8 and 10.
Yeah.
The first chapter is, you know, you start off as this character in this desert. the character that you play as in Journey is not really gendered in any way.
Yeah, I would say that.
I say not really. Definitely not. There is no explicit reference made to the gender of this character at all. And the way that they move is very flowing and very delicate.
I feel like when this game came out, a lot of people talked about this character being female. But I feel like that's just the dated stereotypes we use things such as fluidity.
And when you talk about stereotypes, one thing I should mention is that the general aesthetic of this game is quite Middle Eastern. I'm not enough of a cultural expert to point to specific areas, but it is set in the desert. It has a lot of architecture that's reminiscent of that area. And the clothing as well is somewhat reminiscent of that. And the fact that you wear garb that covers your body from head to toe, I think some people would imply that as being female.
I wouldn't call it the hardest leap to make, so it totally makes
but
sense.
I would also say that if you presume the character's gender based on that, it's not really nuanced thinking.
Sure.
That would be my position. It's a little bit too stereotypical for me to say, they dress like this, therefore they are a woman.
Suffice to say, you're just greeted in this beautiful, expansive desert with this character, and the game immediately directs you to this hill where there's three...
Headstones.
Headstones, yeah. Three headstones right there. And at this very moment, when the game starts, I was just filled this wonderful sense of direction because the game illustrates this hill with a light, and then it gives you this hill to walk to, and you're just moving already forwards.
Absolutely, yeah. Like, this idea of this guiding light on a mountain is the goal that you're heading towards this whole time. You're not exactly sure why at this first part you want to go there either. And I think we might have already mentioned this. There's no dialogue in this game at all.
Yeah, yeah. I think there's no written word either, apart from in the out-of-game kind of aspects of the title. Like, and they even use glyphs and symbols of just the controller. They never actually say or state it. I think the thing that really just immediately made me write notes and just go into depth was how the music fills you with like a soaring crescendo of just excitement and eagerness to get going. Music in games is sometimes it's used like a background and filler, and other times it takes center stage, but it's not part of. It's not woven into the game itself. It's like, oh, this is great music in this game.
Yeah,
but right here. I felt like this wonderful building of tension was
You're
just
definitely
fantastic.
Right. There's different levels of it in different games. Like, so you have a game like, I don't know, like a horror game, like Soma or whatever. Yeah. You're not really meant to notice the music consciously in a game like that. It's all about atmosphere. Mm. You have a game like Doom, where the music is sort of supposed to be a little bit more noticeable, but is still very much about the sensation of the music.
Yeah.
In this, it is a little bit further than that still. And I think it's very impressive to have a game. I say impressive, refreshing to have something where the music is designed to be consciously noticed as part of the experience. The soundtrack in this was composed. That's the one I'm looking for. Composed by Austin Wintory, who is known mainly for games by that game company, but also Monaco.
Assassin's Creed Syndicate?
Yeah. Banner Saga was the one. That surprised me. I didn't know that before researching it for this podcast. But he is a very talented composer. And the music in this is still, I think, the best work I've heard him do, and some of the best musical work in video games at all.
Yeah, I found that the way the music blends together with the overall sound design, apparently they worked very closely with the sound director for the game to make sure it all blends together. Your character can make like a note in this kind of little shockwave that appears out of them that we'll talk about more later. But that note actually is always toned to match the music.
Oh, so it's like it harmonizes.
Yes. Okay. So it harmonizes. So even this noise, you could just spam as much as you want. They still sort of harmonize it with the music so that it works with the whole overall atmosphere. Mm. And the note itself changes as you move through the game.
I didn't know that. I had a sense that it might have harmonized, but I had no idea that it would actually change as you go through.
It just, you know, it changes the harmony to match the different tones.
Right.
So there's moments, you know...
That's almost implicit, isn't it? That when you do sections of the game where they're in a minor key, it's going to be a different note to harmonize with that. That makes sense.
So I just getting excited, being on this hill, the soaring musical note, and then just chirping my way along through this desert. I was very excited.
Yeah, the way the music works to build tone is incredible. And neither of us are musicians. We're not, you know, going to be great at explaining exactly why. But this early part of the game, before you go to this hill and see that mountain in the distance and have that moment of, this is where I'm going, this is my goal, I will move forward. The music's actually a little bit sorrowful, a little bit lonely, because you're sort of in this wide desert. After you go to this hill and you see this, you have that swelling moment, and then you go down the other side of the hill and you see this huge field of gravestones, which I took to be the graves of my own people at this point. And there is that sense of, I have direction, and also I am so forlorn here and so detached from contact. And
I think one of the great things about the game is how it uses these symbols, and it doesn't elucidate on them too much. It keeps the story nice and broad, so you can draw a lot of personal meaning from it.
Yeah.
Because I walked through that field of graves, but I didn't feel too bad about it. I accepted it as, this must be a place where our people get buried.
Yeah.
As well. And so,
I felt like I was one of the last members of a dying people, and that filled me with a lot of sadness. You mentioned that you have this swelling when you go to the top of this hill. Just on that idea of the monomyth, that step is known as the call, or the call to adventure. So this is the moment in the game where your character is asked to depart on this journey into the mystical realm, you know, and go on that journey of the hero. And so, like, again, there's a lot of very, very clear moments that line up with the monomyth.
Yeah.
And again, they do that without explicitly stating it. No one comes to you and says, hey, you have to go on an adventure to save our people. I'm the king. Get some golden fleece, you know? Now, I think it's still very powerful.
Yeah, and the way they use the symbols of the hill and the music, it's the only point on the horizon. Just very clever.
Yeah. After you dance around there for a little bit, you get your scarf, which is the main sort of gameplay element of Journey, where you have this scarf that grows over time as you collect these little runes that, to me, represented the stories and history of this culture.
Yeah.
The scarf is used to float, basically, or fly or glide, whatever word you want to use for it.
And all of those words are so reductive. It's something you have to watch as the character glides and moves through to really appreciate how beautiful it is. It's like a gust of wind picks you up.
Yeah.
And you are just leaves in autumn flying through the sky.
And Journey does take some of those little elemental themes, motifs, whatever, from previous That Game Company games. Flow is all about water, and Flower is all about wind. Yeah. And in this, you have water and wind sections kind of, as well as sand, as this main sort of element of this game. The scarf is really fun to use, and as you say, you kind of feel as though you're gliding and being lofted up on the wind. But this, again, back to the monomyth, getting that scarf is a step known as supernatural aid, where the hero is given a tool that will help them on their quest. In Star Wars, it's the lightsaber. In certain Greek myths, it's like the blessing of a god, things like that. And so, again, another big old checkbox in the hero's journey. This opening tutorial area, you can't encounter anybody else in this area. And something we should actually mention as well, a big gameplay feature of Journey is this idea of emergent multiplayer or like accidental multiplayer.
Yeah, basically at certain points in the game, you can be joined by someone.
And we say certain points, they're not scripted. Like, the tutorial area is the only point where it can't happen. But dynamically, just out in the world, if someone kind of happens to be in the same area as you, you see them.
The game just matches you together, only with one other person.
It can never be more than one.
Yeah, so it'll just be the two of you. And this can happen throughout it. And I think we'll talk about our experiences with encountering people as we move through it.
Yeah, definitely.
But that's definitely very important to mention up front.
See, this early point of the game, you know, you're learning to use the scarf. You're encountering these floating pieces of scarf fabric. They recharge your powers. They kind of dance and float around.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're learning those mechanics, and that ends with you heading to basically an altar or potentially a gravestone of, like, maybe a revered member of your old people.
It's surrounded by the smaller sort of gravestones, and it itself resembles these characters that you then do see. And it was kind of implied that by their size, they're like tower over you, that they are important in your culture.
Yeah, they're like, you know, potentially ancestors, maybe some kind of god figure. But you encounter the first, we'll call them altars. You encounter the first altar to them. And this is the only sort of cutscene type stuff that happens in the game, where you enter sort of this spirit realm facing one of these towering white figures. And then a story is told through, not cave paintings, but like a visual history that you might see, you know, painted by like ancient Egyptian cultures or ancient Greek cultures.
Yeah, I think the Greek pots is something. Yeah. It's like that, but more Mesopotamian, like more less of that sort of Greek style. It's more simplified.
The artistic style, I don't know the word for it, but it is in that genre of recorded history via painting, like large mural painting.
Yeah.
And so you start to see little hints at what the story behind your culture is. After that, a large gate opens, which you walk through, representing the crossing of the first threshold, the next step in Joseph Campbell's hero's journey.
This game really does follow those beats.
Yeah, and we'll talk a little bit about more where that falls apart. Like I said, Star Wars is an example of one that's used a lot. What's normally sort of at the 60% mark of a hero's journey in most of our current stories is like the 95% mark, because that lines up better with a three-act structure.
Yeah.
This game does that as well, where the penultimate climax of the game is much further along in the game than it would be if it was strictly following the hero's journey. But it definitely does adhere to a lot of those beats. This next section is the first section where you actually can actually run into other players, though. And so that crossing of the threshold represents leaving the typical world and entering the mystical realm. And so part of that is you have a greater sense of exploration, but also that you can encounter other people for the first time.
And the space it gives you is like marked out. You enter this sort of... it's like an embankment, like a valley or something.
Yeah, it's like it's wider than you've been in before, but there is still a sort of a clear extreme to where you can go.
Yeah, and you're basically moving through this space to sort of cross over a bridge that's sort of collapsed. And this is where I did encounter my first other player, my other friend. It's so interesting how, because the game doesn't give you any distinguishing features, it is purely another character like your own. Mirrored in any way apart from behavior.
Yeah.
Their behavior is all you have to draw on for how you think about this person. And so this person to me felt lost because they were just wandering around almost semi like aimlessly.
Yeah.
And they would answer my call as well. As I said, you know, you have a button to play a note and make a call.
Yeah, basically sing.
Yeah. And so we would form these little very short kind of songs where I would basically lead them along. And we would just go around exploring the map, and it was very gentle and very interesting. And it was surprising how quickly I found myself engaged with spending time with this person.
One of the things I think is very good, in our last episode, we talked about the camera position in Horizon Zero Dawn and how the world in Horizon Zero Dawn is very fascinating and beautiful to look at, but how tight that camera is doesn't really make that the focus.
Yeah.
In a game like Journey, the camera is very far out. So you see a lot of the world and you feel quite small in it.
Mm.
And so when you encounter another person, there is a very much a sense of we need to huddle up to some extent because this world is so big and not necessarily hostile, but certainly...
lonely.
Yeah, lonely, certainly overwhelming to some extent.
Yeah.
And this idea that you kind of do want to get close to your partner. The other thing that's really interesting about the singing that you're talking about is, as I said, the scarf depletes when you glide. And especially early on in the game, you only really get one charge of gliding that'll take you maybe 10 meters of gliding, and then your scarf is depleted and you have to recharge it by walking those scraps of material or finding other larger pieces of cloth. Material and cloth. But if you're with a companion, you can sing to each other and that'll recharge each other's scarves. So it really does encourage not just teaming up with people, but using that only method of expression from a mechanical perspective as well, which I think is very, very clever.
Oh, sorry, I agree with you. It just felt like no one else I encountered knew this, right? They would run off and look for scraps of cloth, and I would just, I'm here, buddy. Yeah, I'm your friend.
Just let me sing.
Let's sing together.
Yeah.
And so it was very interesting encountering people, and then them... I felt like I had a real grasp of how to move through the world, probably because of my experience with playing a lot of video games.
Yeah, even in sections of the game where it feels like you have zero direction, they still do that gameplay and level design stuff that does at least give you a vague idea of where you're supposed to go. This section you're in here, it's really obvious where you're supposed to go. They're marked by these large red flowing flags.
Yeah.
So for the idea that someone being lost in that area is incredibly adorable.
Yeah. There was a few moments where I'm standing on the bridge that you eventually do build, and I'm just there sort of going, "Hello! Hello, come on."
Yeah, it's time to move.
We've seen everything.
And I think that's very interesting because you mentioned that there's no visual distinguishers between different players. There are two. One of them is every rune you find makes your scarf longer, which gives you further jumping power or floating power. So, the more experienced the player is represented by the longer scarf.
Because of the glyphs they've found.
Yeah. If you unlock every rune, you also get a white robe instead of a red one. And so, if you encounter a white-robed figure, you know that they are a wise elder as far as the world of Journey is concerned.
And actually, I'm wrong a third time, because every time you complete the game, you get a different bit of embroidery on your robe.
Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah.
So, as you play through it, your like the embroidery just will just increase and get more elaborate.
Okay, too. Yeah, because like mine was sort of low on the hem. It sort of kind of increases up the robe. Yeah, that's very cool.
Yeah.
So, one thing I might actually mention about the supernatural aid step that I mentioned before as well, an important part of that idea is that the tool that is given to the hero to help them is important to them as a character or important to their culture. And the scarf being, you know, what I believe to be a recorded history of this people, because every time you unlock one of these runes, it gets longer and it's, you know, the story of your people is added to the clothing that you wear. That's, I think, very powerful and obviously hugely important to the quest of the character.
Yeah, and as you sort of look into the way, I feel like the cloth and the fly and the energy interacts with what little story you can find, you can see this material is very important to the people and to the creatures that exist in this world.
Yeah, and what I think is really fascinating about that as well is that you sing songs and you'll revitalize these scraps of fabric that have, you know, been weathered and they'll, you know, become bright red again. And these scraps of fabric, after you've reawakened them, also recharge your scarf. Yeah. And so, there's this idea that you're going on this quest and revitalizing this culture, and that culture is revitalizing you at the same time.
Yeah, it's
this,
feeds into it each other.
Yeah, it's really interesting stuff. After you cross the bridge, you end up in the first part of the game where you're really not hemmed in at all. Like, this very wide desert, and the high dunes block your line of sight, so you feel like this place you're in is huge, but you can't actually even see anything on the horizon because the points of interest in this area are obscured most of the time.
Yeah, they're all dotted in between these little dunes.
Mm.
And then this is where you encounter what we have decided to name kite birds, which are basically, like, when I saw them, I immediately thought of those box kites, and they fly around the place, flowing through the desert sand, and they start singing to you as well, and I was immediately endeared to them.
See, I'm not alone in this, but when I first saw them, I could only think of dolphins. They had this sort of playful way. They almost swim through the air rather than fly.
Yeah.
And they kind of chirp at each other and chirp at you. And when you run out of scarf power, see, I was alone for most of my playthrough. I only encountered someone right near the end.
Mm.
If you run out of scarf power, they'll kind of dip down and swim through the sand a little bit and pick you up and recharge you. They're very playful and really, really pleasant and joyous to be around. And it's interesting because, you know, you start this section with this uncertainty that's reflected in the music, these little kind of, not atonal, but kind of lilting notes in the music in this section that hint at, you know, this is exciting, but also very unsure at the same time. And when these kites show up, you feel a lot more secure and they kind of guide you through the desert.
Yeah.
And a really important note is that you don't just find them swimming around doing nothing. You go to these metal cages, basically, and you sing at these cages and they unlock and these kites come out.
Yeah.
And they're sort of playing around with their freedom, and then you're sort of feeding off that emotionally as well. It's very, very cool.
And this is a section that ends with that kind of towered structure where there's a whole bunch of these kite birds sort of contained within it.
Yeah, it's this weird kind of aviary type thing. And just through play and implication, you kind of get the impression that this fabric is used as almost like a power source for this fallen civilization. These little cages that you find out in the desert, they're half buried in sand. You kind of get the impression that these creatures would power some kind of vehicle, maybe, or maybe they'll be transported, and these vehicles or these cages have just been abandoned in the desert.
Yeah.
And by letting them out, you're freeing them from this prison of being a battery, basically.
Yeah, yeah. It's pretty much what they seem to have been treated. And like, and then when you do encounter all of them in this cage, this aviary, and they're almost in like a factory charging it, where there's all of these, I imagine like the faces of a scorpion, these kind of weird glowing faces inside that seem to be being created.
It's like a foundry, like you say, these scarves.
And it's the first kind of hint at the civilization and what it did and how it acted.
It's for the first first, definitely it's the first dark moment.
Mm.
And there are a lot of themes I think this game is playing with, but one of them that I see a lot is this idea of culture versus empire, or like culture versus civilization.
Yeah.
And the idea that there can be a, you know, an oral tradition or a cultural tradition amongst a people that is quite noble, but the reach of a organized civilization can be quite detrimental to, yeah. to the world around it in sort of an environmental sense and sort of a personal freedom sense.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of interesting stuff they do with that. But yeah, this section of you playing around in the desert, which is, you know, beautiful and wide open and really colorful, and the sand is like glittery, it's this gorgeous, ends with this valley that's sort of caught in a sandstorm with this dark factory, and you finish that up by opening it up and letting all of these kite birds out.
Yeah.
And then they pick you up and fly you off to the next section.
And then this gets to one of my favorite sections in the whole game. We are sliding down this hill with all of these kite birds flying around you, and you're dodging through these little stone archways and moving around.
Yeah, this part is fucking incredible. Like, yeah. it's so mobile, and it's just, there's so much speed. Like, the sand is flowing down this hill as, like, partway between, like, water and snow, and it's like you're skiing down it, and it's beautiful, and everything's moving past you so quickly, and there's dozens of these recently freed kite birds that are swimming along with you, and you're using your scarf to do these tricks, and the second you run out of it, one of them will swim down and recharge you so yeah. that you can keep flying along with them. It's so uplifting, and
I can still remember the joy. Joyous. Yeah. From when I would launch off a stone block, and then I would fly through the air in that twisting way that you do, and then the kite birds, even they can even recharge you mid-air if they brush into you. And so sometimes flying and singing out to them and having them come get you, and you're just always constantly moving. And it's just, especially after the previous moment that got a bit dark, it just, they pick the tempo right up with this full moving, flowing forward.
And all of the music, like when you introduce these birds, but it kind of culminates here, is just really playful and bouncy. There's a lot of like higher pitch strings, like violins and things like that. And really, I was going to say floral flutes, but you kind of know what I mean there. There's a lot of trills and things like yeah. that. It's just really dynamic, airy, upbeat music. And the most part, the game doesn't take the camera control away from you. There are a couple of moments where it uses it to show you stuff.
Hmm.
Here isn't really an exception, but because of the way the level's designed, you're always looking forward, and you're moving with a lot of speed. And there's that one really great bit where you go through this sort of hallway and then start skiing down this,
sideways,
this ramp, and the camera juts sideways and looks directly into the setting sun, and this is amazing shadow. And like I said, the sand in a lot of different sections of the game has this glittery effect on it that is just fucking gorgeous, and it never looks better than it does right in that moment. It's just so much fun and so pretty, and you feel, we talk about the sense of direction. This is a part of the game that probably has the greatest sense of direction at all, because you can't actually stop.
Yeah.
Even if you use your scarf to fly against the flow of the sand.
Did you miss that glyph as well?
Yeah. you can't reverse your direction. Yeah. Like, you can at best slow yourself down a little bit.
Yeah.
But you're just moving so quickly, and it's downhill the whole time in a very extreme way as well.
I think there's only one moment in this section where you kind of launch out. And
you land in this still point.
And if you time it right, you can launch yourself out and just go and follow all the kite birds and just keep going. But I liked how it was almost, there's almost a little bit of how if you want, you can spend some time here.
Yeah, it's a bit of a break. It's very, very good for the pacing. And it also, once again, gives you another opportunity to release some of this trapped fabric.
Yeah.
So there are little sort of scraps of fabric, probably about the size of an A4 sheet of paper.
Yeah.
And they'll kind of spin around in little groups, gusts, like almost like fireflies, maybe just like on the spot.
I imagine there's these tiny little mini tornado kind of things.
Yeah, like they don't really seem sentient. They almost seem more like insects that kind of sit on the spot. Then you've got these kite birds that seem a lot more conscious. They're like an animal.
They're certainly far more animated.
Yeah, and they move in directions with like a conscious effort. Like, you'll free one of them and that'll guide you to another one that you can free from another cage and that kind of thing. And these kite birds here will come to your aid of their own volition, whereas the little scraps of fabric will only come to you if you sing to them.
Yeah.
Things like that. But yeah, you have this opportunity here to free a lot more of the scraps of fabric, and then once again, continue this gorgeous skiing section. after you go through that, it ends actually quite abruptly.
Yeah.
You sort of ski through the ruins of basically a city, and then the sand brings you to the center, what I imagine sort of near the center of the city of like the town square or something like that, and just dumps you in a pit just as the sun sets.
Yeah.
And so everything goes dark. The whole color palette goes from these warm pinks that it's had in here to these very cold blues, almost like you're underwater.
Yeah.
And you're just dumped underground, like deep underground, and all of your kite birds are gone.
Yeah, I think that feeling of seeing your friends run off is, as you fall down that hill, I still have the image of the kite birds soaring away from me.
Yeah.
I'm like, no, don't leave me. Yeah. I helped free you. Please come back.
And it's this incredible moment of loneliness, because once again, where you've had all of this movement and a camera that I feel is slightly tighter on you when you're skiing down these hills, it suddenly does move very far out, and you're in this wide underground cavern where everything is quite still and stark and cold. And, you know, once again, Hero's Journey stuff, this is the belly of the whale. This is where we hit the descent and we enter a point of introspection where the character has to look at themselves and the hero has to come to terms with themselves and their place in their society. And that this whole next section is exactly that.
Yeah. Not only of the character, but also, in a way, it feels like the society in general.
Exactly, yeah. And these things that, like, you know, depending on how astute you are or how consciously you're thinking about this stuff, the idea that these scarves are being channeled into some kind of power source for the society is fairly easy to intuit before this point, but this is where they make it incredibly explicit in some of these murals that you see, where they tell the story of the culture. So this whole next section is fascinating. Like I said, it's almost like you're underwater, and not just because of the color change, but they also enforce some pretty strict vignetting that almost makes it look like you're in a submarine and you have like the cloudiness of water in front of you. There are little particles that are almost that are floating slowly on the air. And where prior all of these scarves that were like tied to the ground like flags were kind of flapping in the wind like banners or like wacky inflatable tube men.
Yes.
Now we're actually very slow moving and very upright, almost like seaweed.
Yeah, I think that putting it that way actually really brings that life to life. And the feeling of like almost claustrophobia as you're moving through these tunnels. Mm. It's like, yeah, it's quite aquatic. and then you start to encounter these statues that were being made previously with those,
in that factory.
With the other kite birds. And you encounter these statues. And I remember walking around going, wow, this is like being in like a tank warehouse with these weird machines that seem to feed off color. The flags are everywhere.
Yeah. See, like when I first walked into this section, the music here almost has like this Gregorian monkish kind of chanting underneath it. And so not only is it very, I don't want to say oppressive necessarily, but it is dogmatic in a way, and also quite, you know, sad and mournful and sort of lamentatious, but also almost to some mild extent, not necessarily authoritarian, but certainly, like I said, kind of dogmatic, because it is a little bit reminiscent to me of more Christian music that is, you know, and I think of things like the Catholic Church in the Middle Ages, stuff like that. And you walk into this one room where all of these statues are lined up almost in like almost in like a tribunal, like maybe like church pews, like a church choir almost.
Yeah.
But they're all like staring down at you, and they're monstrously tall, like stories tall, each of these statues. And there's that terrible moment where one of them bursts to life.
Yeah, and it's, they did it so well, because there's a statue in front of you that you're moving towards, but that's not the statue that comes to life. It's one off to the right, and it flattens that statue and catches a kite bird, I think, that's been in front of you.
And they sort of swim almost like a predatory shark through this water-like environment. The way they move is a lot more, to me, reminiscent of swimming than it is of flying. They're made of some kind of metal or some kind of stone, and it seems like they're hunting these scraps of fabric cloth, down and you for food. Mm. Like, they need that energy to continue operating.
Yeah.
And so it's incredibly predatory, and you feel in danger, basically. Yeah. You feel like very much under threat. You feel like prey.
It's the first moment in the game where you actually are concerned about what's going on and how you're moving through the place.
Mm.
It's
effectively a stealth section where you have to avoid these monsters as they search for you.
Quite gentle, but all you need to do is stay out of their searchlight as you sneak through this old ruin of where they've been resting for hundreds of however long they've been. before finally making it out.
If one of them does get you, they consume a section of your scarf, so you lose progress. And also, again, if we're going on this theme of like your connection to your culture, they're feeding off that and removing that from you. And I think that that's very clever in a lot of different ways.
Yeah, and the stone machines, they're depicted as in the murals as what happens when the society kind of collapses. It's like the story is kind of told that, at least my impression of it, was that they built and built and built until it got stretched to the limit, and then they started fighting over what was left. And when you think about how the fabric powers everything and how it kind of powers you, it takes on this almost cannibalistic tone as the people of your race seem to be fighting amongst each other and using their own energy to do that fighting.
Yeah, it's very much an empire that crumbles from within. And I had the exact same read of the story, that this community, this culture found this power of this fabric or this kind of magic that they used to build this huge empire. And then it just, by its own reach, by its own expansion, collapsed in on itself. And then there was infighting. And these are some kind of war machine that was built during that collapse. I think that's really fascinating. And without wanting to get too explicitly political, it wouldn't surprise me if people looked at that, the idea of a number of people fighting over a limited resource in the Middle East, and see some parallels to the real world today and what kind of turmoil that can cause for people who live in that area, and what that kind of imperial influence does to smaller communities and local culture, and how that causes that to break down, you know?
Yeah.
That's not really my explicit read, but I can definitely see that if somebody took that stance on the piece.
I think the great thing about using these kind of broad symbols and keeping things, it's very vague and not explicitly telling you anything, just showing you this story, allows you to draw these kind of interpretations from it and use it to sort of explore different aspects of our own lives.
Yeah, and on that topic of broadness as well, a comment that a lot of people make about the multiplayer in this is that it's kind of effortless because you don't have speech, so there's no language barrier because they remove language from the equation. So you can be playing with someone from Russia or from, you know, Germany or from China, and because everything you do to communicate is based around movement and these songs that you sing, you're on the same level with every person that you kind of meet.
Yeah.
I think it's kind of interesting as well if you consider that from the perspective of what the monomyth is designed to be, this template that all cultures tell stories in similar ways, that the game has this way of making a lot of different people interact with it in the same way, regardless of their nationality. Again, that's clever. It doesn't necessarily say, yep, monomyth is great. Great way to look at stories and cultures. Everyone's the same.
Yeah.
But it is interesting that that's mechanically reinforced as well. And this broadness of interpretation, I think, is part of that.
Yeah. And there's no actual way to hinder other players as well. Because if you look closely, you can sort of see how the game, like, your game state is a little different to the other players. So, you know, if you've summoned the scraps of cloth to you, the other person can still sort of do that as well, even though they don't sync perfectly.
There's no real way to troll someone.
Yeah.
And, like, even in that point where you were ready to move on and the other person wasn't, you could have just kept going.
Yeah, there is nothing but my desire to stay together with this other person.
I think that's the closest you could get, is someone slowing you down if you want to stay with them, but you don't have to.
Yeah, and the game never sort of blocks you from moving on.
On that topic of comfort, I think that in a section like this where you are sort of quote-unquote underwater and being hunted, it's really interesting that the way the scarf creatures look in this area is significantly more like shelter. So when you're up on the surface, it's all windy and flappy, and so you sing a song to the scarf and it'll revitalize, but it just kind of flaps around in the wind.
Yeah.
Here is seaweed. You can kind of nestle yourself in between these scarves, and that kind of shields you. And they also introduce the jelly scarves, which look a bit like jellyfish, and they're quite round and circular, and you kind of swim up through what would be their tentacles. And again, you feel shielded from the dangers of this predatory environment.
And then after this moment of darkness, we're at like this low point, you basically ascend a golden tower.
Yeah. So this, in our monomyth story, is the road of trials. Yeah. You kind of head to this golden tower after there's a moment where it becomes very clear these dragon creatures can't hurt you anymore. There's a big golden barrier, so you're fine.
Yeah.
And so this is a really like positive moment of relief from that and ascension out of this dark place. And the way that you go about doing it is heading to these smaller murals and singing to them to paint them in.
Yeah.
And that recaps your journey so far. And that weaves into this large mural. They all kind of come together in one of these cutscene sequences. So you have this moment of you ascending the tower and looking back on your journey so far, and also having this large mural come together and paint what's coming in the future.
And not only do the murals paint the images of you moving through this world, but the mechanics you use to ascend each section of the tower are reminiscent of each point in the game as well.
Yeah.
So not only is the game mirroring your journey in the pictures, but in what you do to move through this trial, it just recaps what you've learned.
Yeah, and the game is really, really good at echoing itself in this way.
Yeah.
So the story that you learn of the culture, you know, ascending, meeting this peak, falling apart in the war machines, the levels that you encounter echo that. They're similar in, if not necessarily explicit, plot points, definitely in terms of direction and tone.
Yeah.
And then you go to this point where they far more explicitly look back by showing you these murals of what you've already seen and then moving up forward, as well as the gameplay revisiting that as well. And so this sense of progression in a game that only took me like an hour and 40 minutes to go through a solid playthrough for is constantly looking back and looking forward and thinking about progress and time and asking you to think about that, that makes it feel like so much more is happening. And a lot is happening, right?
Yeah.
But it makes you realize how much is happening even in such a short amount of time.
Not a single wasted moment. And even when they look back, it just magnifies what you've experienced. And this is the moment where I encountered my second friend
when I
was playing through it. And so it's good that you mentioned the scarves before. So they had a much shorter scarf than I did, whereas mine was at this point long and flowing and allowed me to soar through the air with ease. I had no problems with these trials. I could almost have just flown around. My scarf was so long. This other person kind of needed a bit of help. And so it became this kind of thing, whereas before I was exploring with this other person, now I was kind of guiding.
Yeah.
And because I would always sort of be one step ahead, I did this thing where rather than triggering the next mural, I just wait for the other person and let them do it. And it'd be funny because they would run up and sing to the mural, and then I would sing to them, and then we would just sing to each other while the temple would move to the next sort of phase.
Yeah, the room sort of fills up with this golden light, and while you're sitting in the golden light, your scarf never depletes. So you can basically fly at will to the surface of where this light is.
Yeah, which is a great move, because the last thing you want to do in a trial like this is get punished by having to start from the beginning constantly.
Exactly, yeah. But it is this great moment of empowerment, regardless of how much scarf you have. It speaks to, again, a very clever element of the game design in this, that if you go through the entire game and never find a bonus glyph to increase the length of your scarf, you can always still progress. Like, there's always a, you know, a dolphin or a kite bird that's going to pick you up and carry you there, or always some kind of path. But when you or I, who have been looking for a lot of these glyphs, get and, you know, have a scarf that's dragging along the ground behind them at this point, it does enhance, to some extent, the ease that you can float with and the momentum that you have through these areas.
Yeah.
There's this idea of variable difficulty in games, that if you're struggling with it, the game will make things easier for you. If anything, this is the opposite of that. So, like, if you're struggling to find these glyphs, you're only going to find the game harder and harder as you go forward. I don't necessarily think that difficulty is the best way to think of it in this case, though, because let's say you're getting a lot of these little
glyphs.
You probably have the skill to wield that power without it being disruptive to the game.
Yeah.
And so you can channel that much more seamlessly than someone who isn't able to platform quite as well. And so it almost keeps them with a level of freedom that will help them through the experience to some extent.
Kind of,
does that make sense? I feel like I'm riffing there.
I can understand that it gives them a focus because...
Yeah, that's what I'm getting at. It keeps their movement more focused.
Whereas I was just flowing through the air at random, soaring around, trying to discover things.
You know, the very first point in the tutorial where they first teach you to sing? You can actually skip that part if you have enough scarf.
Yeah.
And so I think that that's a good example of, like, players with a lot more experience can just charge forward, but new players would never be able to get past that point without being forced to learn how to sing there. And so, this tower is another good example of that, where if you don't have a lot of scarf power, you've got to jump from jelly to jelly to jelly, and it takes you straight to the mural. Yep. But someone like you or I, we can just glide around this room as much as we want and then just land at whatever we want in whatever order we want. And so, it gives you the freedom to your level of ability to explore.
Yeah, interesting. Mm. Especially as the game wants you to replay it again by having those different costumes and those different options. It's an interesting touch to build into the game itself its own difficulty.
Yeah.
Without making that difficulty an explicit choice at the start.
Yeah, and it's difficulty, again, not necessarily from a challenge perspective, but from a exploration perspective. Mm. Like, you are given movement options that are more difficult because you can handle them. Yeah. I think that's very intelligent. The chapter that you get to after going through this tower is actually on the mountain itself. And as I said, the tapestry does show that you're going to be contending with strong winds and cold. And then you go to that section. And this is very different because it's the first time you're walking on anything that isn't sand.
Yeah.
And it's white and cold. And there's these ghastly winds just cutting through you.
And the rest of the game, the wind has always been at your back, pushing you forward. And this is like the first time when the wind is pushing into you and slowing you down, forcing you to move from stone to stone.
Again, this is such a clever element of design. So, in some of the wider deserts where you don't have hard walls preventing you from going out, the wind is what will push you back. And so, they've seeded this idea that you are weaker than the wind, that you are lightweight, and even moderate winds in this place will affect the way you move. Something very interesting I saw on an extra credits video on this game, actually. One of the steps in a hero's journey is refusal of the call, where the hero says, no, I'm not going to do it. This is where, you know, Luke Skywalker says, no, I've got to do my chores on my farm. I can't go fight the rebellion, Uncle Ben. Not Uncle Ben. Obi-Wan. In a video game, that's very hard to do and have the player
accept it and not be frustrated, and
not just have it be a cutscene.
Yeah. Or a magical invisible wall.
Yeah. And the thing that this extra credits video postulated was that at some point, a lot of players will stop and go, wonder what happens if I just walk off to the left.
I did that.
I did that too. And they kind of posit the idea that that moment that most players have while playing this game is the refusal of the call. It is you being like, no, fuck this fucking mountain. I'm going to go walk out in the desert.
Interesting. And by building this wind kind of thing in,
As the futility of that refusal,
they've built in that any point during the game, you could have a refusal for the call when it's naturally appropriate for you.
And it also seeds the fact that when you get to this idea of you will contend with wind, most players will have already suffered at the hands of the wind and know that this is a big deal.
Yeah.
You know, saying, oh, there's going to be a lot of wind in most video games isn't really a problem.
Yes, I don't think most video games even model the wind.
So, you walk through this snow and the cold robs your scarf of power, so you can't fly most of the time. You just have to walk.
Yeah.
This is the only part of my playthrough where I ran into another person.
Oh.
And this person had a much longer scarf than me. And it was very interesting to be walking through this wind where the snow is whipping up and I can barely see in front of me. And I just see this tiny little hint of movement. And I'm like, oh my God, there's someone here. There's someone here who can help me, feel safe in this environment. And so I charged after them. They didn't know because it's so loud and like they're so much further ahead of me. And you move so slowly as you trudge through this wind. It took me so long to catch up with them. I was afraid that I wouldn't be able to. Like, I was desperately chasing after them. And then I eventually caught them because they took shelter in this cave. And that was where I had the opportunity to catch up to them. And I sang to them a little bit and they sang back. And they'd already collected the secret in this cave. I went up to collect the secret. I went back down and they were gone.
Oh, I know the exact cave you're talking about.
Yeah.
That's really sad.
And so they greeted me. They said hello, but they left me in this place. It was just like, oh, no. And so like this emotional moment where I was desperate to seek out the company of another person in this really, really harsh environment. And then to be let down by that, it's like, it isn't something I've had in another game before.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And especially as I find there's something so endearing about the songs you sing with other players.
Yeah.
And that just makes it so exciting to meet and greet them. And then, and you don't just talk, you sing together, you commune, you're connecting. For them to just leave, it's just like, well, does this not mean anything to you anymore? Like,
yeah.
To be left behind like that?
Yeah, I mean, like, it was powerful. I didn't take it personally. Like, some people prefer to play alone. That's fine. But like I said, this little moment and this little emergent story and this emergent relationship, again, it's something that can't really happen in other media.
Yeah.
This section does go on for a little while, but eventually, you know, more of these statues appear and they're trying to hunt you. But eventually you get to a point where the wind is overpowering and you're desperately trying to keep walking, but your scarf actually starts to break apart until it's worn down to nothing.
And then you just freeze overall.
And then you freeze and fall to the ground and die.
Yeah.
And again, I really feel like we're underserving the music in this thing because it's such an incredible part of the experience. The music in this section is, the title of the track is Nadia, which is the surname of the guy in Community. That's an intertextual reference. No, it is a word of Arabic origin, which means the lowest point.
Okay.
And that's why the character's called that in Community, but it makes no sense because that character is never at his lowest point. He's one of the most together characters in the show. Never mind, it's not important.
Great Community fact, and that's not where we are.
Yeah, so this moment of death, of the lowest point in the game, is accompanied by a track called Nadia, and it is... Honestly, it's weird to say this. It is the most explicitly Arabic reference in the game because when you have architecture and clothing, I mean, I'm not an expert in these areas, but they can often be taken from many different cultures and be sort of like
an amalgamation,
and so not be quite as specific, but this is literally an Arabic word.
Yeah.
After this death, the character meets with a number of these spirit figures that they've seen throughout the game. Prior to this, you only ever meet with one at a time, and I get the impression it's the same one each time.
To me, I got the opposite. Each one you met was a different one that you then meet all of them together at the end.
That makes more sense, I think, because you're going to these different altars that we potentially consider to be graves, and so one would presume that a different person is buried at each place.
Potentially. They're all identical.
Yeah, and I thought it was a single character that you were meeting each time, and then at the end you actually meet a group of these elders. And maybe it is, like you say, you've met one in each turn, and then they come together. This moment in the hero's journey is known as Atonement with the Father, which in most myths is less about a specifically paternal figure and more about a being of supreme power.
Yes.
They often have control over life and death. Mm-hmm. In Star Wars, as an example, this is where Luke, you use the Force, Luke.
And he puts away his targeting computer and he blows up the Death Star.
Yeah, and he blows up the Death Star because he accepts his relationship with what this person represents, his place in the world in relation to this all-powerful figure. And he is granted this supernatural knowledge. Luke is given the use of the Force.
Yeah.
That moment is known as apotheosis, where the hero gains some supernatural knowledge or supernatural ability that will empower them, but also potentially empower humankind.
Mm.
And in this game, it is accompanied by the resurrection of your character and the complete lengthening of your scarf to its fullest potential.
And you just fly through the air.
And it is amazing. It is just such an incredibly emotionally fulfilling and overwhelming moment of relief and joy and empowerment and direction and flow and freedom. It's just incredible.
From this rise from the dead, you fly through a vortex in the clouds and the wind and the cold while these stone serpents are trying desperately to get at you, but you soar and then you burst through the clouds.
Yeah, and above the storm.
Yeah, and you're greeted to this view of the top of the mountain and it shines above you as all the creatures you've encountered on your journey seem to be clustered here and giant cloth whales.
Yeah, that you first meet back at the tower that we failed to mention.
Yeah, and heaps and hundreds of these kite birds. It almost feels like you've encountered Eden.
Yeah, and that's a really great way of explaining it. Like, Eden is just like, it's so beautiful and bright and sunny, and there's, even though there is still snow, there's so much more life.
Yeah.
And once again, the game echoes the path that you've walked up to this point, where each, as you fly through this point, you, as you say, you re-encounter a lot of these creatures, but in the order that you encountered them first. Like, you meet the kite birds, and then you meet the jellies and the seaweed, and then you meet the whales, and there's another golden pool of this light that allows you to thrust upwards. And then right at the end, you're charging along this torrent of golden light to this gap in the mountain that you've been heading to the entire time.
Yeah, the mountain's always been depicted as like this dual peaks with the light in the middle.
Yeah, like a crevice in the center there. Yeah. And, you know, part of me wonders if that's supposed to be Yonic in some way. I doubt it. It would theoretically make sense. One of the steps that the game arguably skips, or two steps, is Womanus Temptress and meeting with the goddess.
Hmm.
Womanus Temptress is more just about the temptations of mundane life, generally money, fame, sex, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But meeting with the goddess is something that comes before Atonement with the Father, where the hero is given another tool to proceed in their journey.
Man, Joseph Campbell's real old school with his terminology, huh?
Yeah. If you write that a lot of myths are sexist, that doesn't inherently mean that you are sexist. So right. Part of it could be on him and part of it could be on patriarchy through the thousands of years prior anyway.
True.
So I don't want to throw shade at a guy when I haven't read his book.
Yep.
But yeah, a lot of the terminology is gendered, and most people, even Campbell, argues that the gender shouldn't be totally defining.
Yeah.
The point is, like, you get to this crevice in the top of the mountain and you slowly walk into the light. And one thing we didn't mention is the game actually starts with the image of this light traveling through the desert. And when you walk through into the crevice here, you're embraced by the light until, you know, you can no longer see the character. And another one of these orbs of light launches from the tower and it traces back through the entire journey that you've taken in reverse.
Yeah. The game is always echoing itself and re-magnifying.
And again, I've neglected to mention the music here. Both when you're charging up the mountain, the music is almost like a homage to all of the pieces in the music that have happened before it, but with so much more energy and so much more breath behind them.
Mm.
And then when you move back through this, we get a similar kind of thing where we are looking back at the journey you've taken through the game, but it's a little bit more reflective. It's a little bit more. And this is where I see people say, I felt sad at the end of this game, because this is the credit sequence where you have this very introspective, reflective, bittersweet homage to all of the tracks that you've heard up to this point. And again, it just gives you this real sense of, I've gone through all of this stuff and now I walk back to my regular life. And one of the final stages in the hero's journey is the return, where the hero goes from that mystical realm and takes what they've learned or what they've achieved back to humanity, and ideally for the benefit of humanity, you know? And, you know, in a lot of myths, that's like some boon that they've taken from the gods or some knowledge about whatever. It could even just, in some cases, be the lessons that they've learned themselves, arguably, you know, like in The Last Starfighter or whatever. And so the game, I think, is just so clever in the way that it makes you feel in yourself that return, that crossing of the threshold again back into the mundane, both as you putting the controller down and walking away, but also as this character flowing back to the start of the game.
Yeah, and especially when it rests upon the start screen.
Mm.
Like, the game does a full loop. You return right to the beginning, and then it just says, begin a new journey.
Yeah. And once again, something I'm aping from extra credits here is this idea that what you take back as a player is the knowledge that you earned through the game. And so if you run into a couple of inexperienced people like you did, you are now more equipped to help them and to guide them and to be that nurturing figure. And that's how you benefit the mundane world, quote unquote, of the players in this game.
Yeah. I think it's interesting that when you do that look back, you actually see other figures on their own journey.
Yeah, that's so good.
And it's mirroring this almost endless journey that that you are all undertaking.
I realized that I said that I only encountered one other player through my playthrough here. That's strictly true, only one other robed figure. But at a number of different points, if you look to the sky, you can see lights traveling back. Those are players as well.
Really?
Yeah. And so I had two or three of those that I saw overhead as players reach the end and then return back to the beginning.
The multiplayer mechanic in this game is so intriguing in how it builds into the narrative.
Yeah, it's so fucking good. Yeah. And it is very much a cliche to say that, you know, a lot of games don't tell stories unique to games. Like, I get that. A couple of years ago, that was a massive conversation to the point of exhaustion, that any game that was linear was bad, that any game that had cutscenes was bad. Every game should be Half-Life, and people were completely obtuse to the fact that even though the game doesn't take control away from you to have a cutscene, it still totally has cutscenes.
Yeah, like,
that's how the story is delivered. People exposition dumps.
It locks you in a lot of rooms and people talk around you.
And so a lot of people would point to a game like The Last of Us and say, that's a great story, but it isn't a story that's unique to games, because if you just sat down and watched a supercut of the cutscenes, you'd get 95% of what that game's doing.
Yeah.
And I think that that's a fair point to make. Even though I love The Last of Us and I think it is one of the high achievements of, at the very least, big budget games, this does so much in such a short amount of time, and it does things that other games haven't done.
Yeah.
And I think that that's just so worth remembering. Yeah. I think Journey occupies a really weird place in the conversation where people remember it fondly, but not often. You know what I mean? It's not that the game is forgettable, but it feels so much like the time of this game has passed.
Mm.
And I think that that mission statement that we have about part of what we do here on the Slowpokes being holding up games that do unique things, even if the hype train has moved on from them, I feel like that's very true of us discussing this game.
I just feel like there's some lessons there, especially in the multiplayer. I can't get over it, how it builds into the narrative, which I feel is so removed from a lot of multiplayer experiences. I think of like, I mean, the first one that comes to mind would be Borderlands, where players are kind of just stuck together and it turns an experience just into a rabble-rousing kind of session.
Yeah.
It doesn't really build into it. And it's so rare for... I think I can only think of one game with a co-op kind of component that even builds into like an asymptomatic, where the players are slightly different. And that
you
was,
mean asymmetrical?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah.
Asymptomatic? Good Lord. I do not know words.
That's when you have a disease, but you can't tell.
Oh, no, I feel like I'm exhibiting asymptomatic things. But asymmetrical kind of gameplay co-op experience, which was Fear 3.
Yeah.
Right? Where one person's a ghost. And the
it's
other...
still, like, it's so competitive and adversarial as well. Like,
but it's just so rare that you can join another player and have this experience.
The thing with Fear 3 as well, like, even if the multiplayer does suit the narrative, it is ultimately disruptive. You know, that's the point of it. Whereas in this, the multiplayer is so effortless. It just dovetails so seamlessly into the experience. The first time I played this game, I don't think I had an internet connection because I was at my girlfriend's house up in the country when I played it. And so I didn't encounter anybody on my first playthrough.
Mm.
This second time, I did run into these people, and it does enhance the experience, but it detracts in no way whatsoever. Yeah. Like, it only builds, and it also, like I said, is just so simple when like, the way that that's implemented to my actual play experience.
What's the problem with a perfect piece of design? You don't notice it's there.
Yeah.
Right? And I feel like the design in this is so perfect that I don't feel like anyone paid any attention to it.
Mm.
When you almost want to get on a hill and be like, look and steal and adapt and grow from this.
Yeah, it's very powerful. Now, I will say a lot of the stuff I read in preparation for this episode to see how other people reacted to the game, a lot of people are deeply emotional about their relationship with this game. They talk about it being a spiritual experience. But I think one thing that is worth considering is that ultimately, in a lot of ways, the game is somewhat minimalist in the way it explores themes, and certainly in the way that it explores plot. I think that that makes it a powerful emotional experience, but it probably doesn't make it the most transformative artistic experience that I've had in games, especially when you consider some of the other stuff we played on this podcast. Now, that's not to say that the game is lesser for any reason for that. I mean, unless you're measuring it very specifically by that metric. But I think that that's, again, it just builds into this very approachable, very smooth build and design where there's no cracks, there are no spikes that you run into, there's nowhere that you just get stuck. And again, when we talk about the sadness that some people have said they've left this game with, I think that's part of what that is the seamlessness it has with our real lives and with our, like, the emotional interface with the game is so smooth.
Yeah, especially how it it's an experience you go through and then it returns you. It does everything. It follows such a traditional structure. Like, it does all of these things to help move you through the journey that you go on. And I think, that's just why it just leaves people with that kind of experience.
And I think that the absence of a hard ending, like, there isn't, when you go and watch a Marvel movie, you go and watch the credits and it's the big score and the black screen, and then you'll have an after credit scene and then the lights come up and you walk out. Like, it just feels like the ending of that is so much more truncated than what the ending of this game is, both because of how it leaves you feeling and how it just cycles back into itself, just like the traditional construction of the monomyth. But I feel like if we let ourselves, we could talk about this for another 3 hours. We might leave it here.
Yes.
The game is, I imagine, relatively cheap at this point.
Yep.
It is like an hour and a half, 2 hours long, even with everything we've said. the game is not really harmed by spoilers because plot isn't really what it's about.
Yeah,
everything we've said fails to capture 85% of what the experience of playing this game is.
95, yeah. Most of the experience playing this game. Yeah, I had plot beats spoiled for me, and it was still affecting as an experience to have. And it's just the way it returned me to a wonderful, just kind of neutral state.
On a sort of an argumentative point or a logical point here, is it possible to spoil something when the entire point of it is you have heard this story 1,000 times before? Hey, have you ever heard someone tell you a story? Guess what? It was this one.
I don't know. That sounds like an argument to have on another podcast.
Yeah. Well, that, I believe, is Journey for this fortnight. Thank you, everybody, for joining us for that one. If you like what we do, you can find us on iTunes. Give us a review. We deeply appreciate it. Our website is slowpokespodcast.com. Twitter is @slowpokescast. Facebook is facebook.com/slowpokespodcast. And we're also on YouTube.
Yes.
You can just search for us on there.
Mm-hmm. Now, our next game... games.
It's a 2-for-1 special, son!
Double feature! We're going to be playing Duskers and Shower With Your Dad Simulator 2015. Do You Still Shower With Your Dad? Which is the full title of that game, and I thought I should
represent it. I just call it Shower With Your Dad.
No, David. It is Shower With Your Dad Simulator 2015. Do You Still Shower With Your Dad?
Okay, so I'm very much looking forward to Shower With Your Dad Simulator 2015. Do You Still Shower With Your Dad? As well as Duskers.
Yes.
Duskers is a game I've already played a bit of. It's sort of a roguelike where you command drones through a text-based console.
That is the most boring, exciting sentence I've ever encountered. It excites me so much.
Shower With Your Dad Simulator 2015, Do You Still Shower With Your Dad, is one of these breakout games that came out of nowhere. Yep. I still don't really know what it is, other than the fact that apparently it is not what you're expecting.
It's just ridiculous, I think is a word.
Yeah. High octane might potentially be another. I don't know. I'll find out when I play it.
Yeah.
So join us next time for both of those games in our 2-for-1 special. I have been David.
I have been John.
Thank you for joining us for the Slowpokes.